That was the year.
Recreating notable events of passing time. Reviving memories of men and women who have contributed to the history of a modern world. That was the year. As pompous and beribboned representatives of 56 nations thronged lobbies of hotels in Geneva, Switzerland, and prepared to convene the next day in the first meeting of the beleaguered League of Nations, the evening of January 15, 1920, ushered in a far different phase in the history of the United States. The Volstead Act, which was to put teeth into the Prohibition 18th Amendment to the Constitution, was to become effective at midnight. Dryers celebrated with dry dinners and prayerful gatherings in churches and private homes, while wets made a last night of it, tippled a final sacrifice at the shrine of Bacchus, imbibed gallons of legal liquid, which on the morrow would become contraband. Various were the opinions as to the ultimate results of America's noble experiment.
Said Commissioner of Internal Revenue, Daniel C. Roper,
"The prohibition law will be violated, extensively at first, slightly later on, but it will, broadly speaking, be enforced and will result in a nation that knows not alcohol."
Vehement dry statesman William Jennings Bryan observed,
"The liquor issue is as dead as slavery."
And Treasury Department's chief chemist, Dr. A.B. Adams, stated in an interview,
"There's nothing to this home brewing business. It's too much trouble for uncertain results. They may try it once or twice, but not more."
While on the other side of the fence, indicative of wet philosophy, said United States Senator Edge,
"Tonight is the night that the American people are going to bid goodbye to their freedom."
...1920, that was the year.
On the grounds of an estate in the picturesque town of Emmerungen, Holland, a stocky, Teutonic 69-year-old man fills his days with reading the classics, conversing amiably with village youngsters, and sawing cordwood. On the morning of January 17, his wife approaches him.
Wilhelm?
Guten Morgen, Hermione.
Did you like your breakfast?
Jawohl. Ah, that omelette tasted like the old days.
I have brought the paper, Wilhelm.
Oh? Is there anything worth reading?
I am afraid there is.
Let me see it, please. So, the Allies are trying to bring me to trial, eh? I expected this.
But why, Wilhelm, why? Have you not done enough? You have abdicated. You have given up all your power. Have you not suffered enough? What can they gain by this...
Reprisal?
Your reprisal.
Oh, it is just a further means of effecting punitive action. They think by bringing me to trial to appease their people.
Well, it cannot be. I have given most of my life to Germany. By this war, we have made a gross mistake. We have committed an unpardonable crime, the crime of patriotism. But they cannot take the rest of my life. What is left of it is mine and yours, Liebchen. Come, we will have another cup of coffee, and in the meantime, burn this newspaper.
On January 23, Queen Wilhelmina of the Netherlands refused to deliver the ex-Kaiser of Germany and King of Prussia into the hands of the Allies. Finally, precisely 1 month after the original demand for extradition, on February 16, the Allied powers, recognizing Holland's right to hold the ex-Kaiser as a refugee, requested that he be interned somewhere less adjacent to the German border than Amerongen. Quickly acceding, Holland moved the elderly country gentleman to Doorn, where he continued to read newspapers and the classics, greet roadside youngsters, and saw cordwood.
1920. That was the year.
On August 18, United States Secretary of State Bainbridge Colby announced that through the ratification by the Tennessee legislature of the 19th Amendment to the Constitution, the right of suffrage had been granted to American citizens without regard to sex. In other words, in the ensuing national election, there were to be 9,500,000 feminine voters added to the polling lists.
Said Governor of Ohio, James M. Cox, Democratic presidential candidate,
"The civilization of the world is saved. The mothers of America will stay the hand of war and repudiate those who traffic with great principles."
Observed U.S. Senator from Ohio, Warren G. Harding, Republican presidential candidate,
"Well, all along I have wished for the completion of ratification, and have said so. So I am glad to have all the citizenship of the United States take part in the presidential elections."
Said ardent suffragist, Mrs. Carrie Chapman Catt,
"We suffragists have worked so hard and against such great odds that we have forgotten how to play."
That was the year 1920.
Late in September, in the office of Charles A. Comiskey, owner of the Chicago White Sox.
"All right, Eddie. Go on, tell the rest of it."
"Okay. Well, they came to us with the idea that we should throw the World Series last year."
"Who's us?"
"Well, there were eight of us. I wrote the names down here."
"All right, go ahead."
"Well, if we'd throw the series to Cincinnati, they were going to pay us $100,000.
$100,000?
Yep, but we never got it."
"How much did you get?"
"Well, they only paid us the first installment of $10,000.
All right, what then?"
"They double-crossed us with a fake telegram. We thought it was all fixed, but we never got any more than $10,000.
"You know, of course, this is tough on me."
"Yeah. Yeah, I know, boss."
"Okay. That's all just now, Eddie. I'll communicate with you later."
"Yeah, boss. All right."
"Miss Hayes, take a letter."
"Yes, sir. Ready, Mr. Comiskey."
"Send the same letter to each of these eight men. You and each of you are hereby notified of your indefinite suspension as a member of the Chicago American League Baseball Club. Your suspension is brought about by information which has just come to me, directly involving you and each of you in the baseball scandal resulting from the World Series of 1919. If you are innocent of any wrongdoing, you and each of you will be reinstated. If you are guilty, you will be retired from organized baseball for the rest of your lives if I can accomplish it. Until there is finality to this investigation, it is due to the public that I take this action, even though it costs Chicago the pennant. Chicago American Baseball Club, by Charles A. Comiskey."
Soon after, the eight offending members of the Chicago White Sox, termed by sports writers the Black Sox, were indicted and subsequently brought to trial. At the conclusion of the trial, the eight players were acquitted, but none was ever admitted back into major professional baseball.
...1920. That was the year
that Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks were married, that Charles Ponzi's financial wizardry was exposed as a patent fraud, that the Ku Klux Klan, under the command of Imperial Wizard William J. Simmons, white-robed and masked, met in midnight assemblies.
That was the year
that you wept with Jane Cowell and Smiling Through, laughed at the Ed Wynn Carnival and mob ticket offices for admission to the Blue Flame, starring the movies Number One Vamp, Theda Bara.
That was the year
that you were reading Edith Wharton's The Age of Innocence and Sinclair Lewis's Main Street.
And that was the year
that you were singing,
"Here's a Japanese sandman, making on with the news. Just an old second-hand man, to buy it all day from you. He will take every sorrow of the day that is through, and he'll give you tomorrow to start life anew.
Then you'll be a bit older in the dawn when you wake. Then you'll be a bit bold.
You will be a little bold with a new day you'll make. Ah, here's the Japanese sandman, trading silver for gold. Just an old second hand man, trading
new days for all. Won't you stretch imagination for a moment and come with me? Let us hasten to a nation lying over the western sea.
Hide
behind the cherry blossom, here's a sight that will please your eyes.
There's a baby with a teddy on the grass,
every sorrow on the day that is true.